The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. What are we in the United States? Are we an empire? Are we the leader of the world? Are we the arsenal of democracy? Are we the protector of freedom? Are we the last bastion of civilization and the only hope for the entirety of the Western industrialized world for survival in this gigantic conflict between the poor and the rich, the new global conflict between two worlds, one rich, one poor, which is developing in the battlefield is the globe itself? We're 6% of the population of the world, but we're wallowing around in 50% of its wealth. It's just a fact. It happens to be that way. Many people have never thought to investigate how that came to be, whether we earned it, produced it for ourselves, whether we even deserve it. But notwithstanding those very large considerations at the moment, the question is, since we've got it, do we want to keep it? Do we even want to increase it, or do we want to give it away? There is a gigantic battlefield being drawn today, which is the entirety of the world itself. And on one side are the have nations, on the other side are the have-not nations. On the one side are the industrialized, basically non-communist and democratic type nations with, only about 700 to 800 million citizens, combining Europe and Britain, the United States, South Africa, Australia, Canada, as opposed to the bulk of the remainder of the entirety of the world. But those 750 or so million citizens are consuming most all of the resources of the world, produce just about all of its manufactured commodities and goods, and enjoy, of course, the very highest standards of living in all the history of humankind. Now, on the other hand, there are many, many nations, around 100 or more of them, undeveloped, poor, poverty level, militant, usually in the throes of violent overthrows, coup d'etat, bloodletting, guerrilla warfare, civil war and strife, usually the pawns being pushed out in the forefront by the Soviet Union in its attempt to swallow up major portions of the world in its attempt for world domination ultimately. Witness what is happening in Africa with growing Soviet influence in country after country in Africa right now. But these have-not countries, or the so-called third world countries, are demanding an ever larger share of that wealth that is presently in the possession of the 750 million or so of the democratic and industrialized countries. You see, those states represent about 2 billion people, millions and millions of whom live all their entire lives on an abject poverty level in the shadow of disease and starvation. Now, so far as we see this global battle beginning to shape up, so far the conflict has been limited to economic pressures, to political pressures, to fiery speeches from new despots emerging in such faraway places as Africa and Uganda, with General Amin making statements about the free world, the United States and Britain in particular. So the conflict is limited to various forming of blocs and pressure groups, especially the oil-producing countries of OPEC. It is limited to speeches in international forums using the hollow, empty shell of the disunited non-nations, commonly called the United Nations, for a sounding board of third-world propaganda against the industrialized non-communist states. Of course, to the rousing applause of all of those countries who have been the recipients of American aid and generosity for these many decades. So there is a conflict. Right now it's limited basically to political and economic pressures. But when will that conflict begin to emerge in direct warfare to the point of an actual global worldwide struggle? Are we headed toward a nuclear bomb World War III? There are a lot of exaggerated fears, people say, about some of the radical poor nations, what they might do. So many of them desirous of jumping immediately into the nuclear club, and so many of them, ironically enough, who have been promised nuclear reactors by the United States. Then they could go about the business of making themselves a low-yield, maybe a kiloton range or so, dirty bomb of the type that obliterated about 92,000 lives instantly in Hiroshima, or Nagasaki. They could then indulge in a little nuclear saber-rattling, not only against their own immediate neighbors, as in the case which might actually happen between India and Bangladesh, for example, some of the nations in Africa, for another example, Egypt, for example, against Israel. And as you begin to ask, what would the world be like if, for example, on the island of Timor or Indonesia or Malaysia or the periphery of Southeast Asia, some of the nations that have already gone communist, if they all possessed nuclear arsenals, what kind of a world would it be? Would there be radical poor nations after acquiring nuclear explosives who might even try to blackmail rich nations in giving up their wealth by threatening a nuclear holocaust if they didn't? At any rate, it's time to take a good long look and to appraise the world the way it really is, because there is a gigantic conflict shaping up. And that requires some introspection on the part of the United States. What are we? What should we be? Today you begin to hear a great deal of talk about isolationism. People have actually said, let's go isolationist and let other people solve their problems. There are people in Congress, people in governmental positions who actually believe that today. On the one hand, when you look back in the overview past the post-war period when the United States emerged at the end of World War II, just about holding all the marbles, where we were the biggest military and industrial power the world had ever seen, we alone possessed the nuclear weapons with which to virtually intimidate the entirety of the world. The one nation we didn't seem to intimidate was the Soviet Union, up until about 1950, when it was announced the Soviet Union had also developed a hydrogen bomb. Then began the Cold War and a time of compromise, a gigantic conflict which even now still continues, no matter the discussion of détente. But from that time on, the United States, like it or not, was shoved into a role of playing empire. Like it or not, accept it or want it, rejoice over it, the United States had all the marbles. It was the big hope for all of these underdeveloped countries to supply the aid, meaning usually money, but also the technicians, the know-how, the skills, the assembly line, mass production methods of American industry, which were, through the Marshall Plan program, exported over to the shattered shards of a prostrate Germany, which very quickly, because of the German willingness to work, resulted in what was called a post-war miracle, the boom that took a prostrate Germany into the superpower status, at least economically and industrially, in the course of only a very few decades. To where that nation now is stronger, more powerful, more viable, so far as its economy and its industrial base on a per capita basis, than is the United States itself. And when you combine all the countries of Europe together, Europe then comprises a viable, powerful system of trading, of manufacturing, and industrial states, which, if it were armed with nuclear weapons, would be the biggest power on the face of the earth, not the United States, which would then revert to number two or even number three. But there's something rather annoying that we begin to see happen in this country that I think we ought to talk about. I don't know quite how to label it, whether to call it a vast hypocrisy of attempting to wash our filthy linen before the rest of the world to prove how clean we really are. I don't really understand this exercise of attempting to uncover all undercover operations, of taking the cloak off all governmental secrecy, of exposing CIA and FBI agents abroad, of taking everything to the people because, quote, they have a right to know, end quote, and thus effectively forcing our own government to cease functioning so far as foreign policy is concerned when we, like it or not, live in a world filled with tigers. We live in a world filled with people who want us dead. We live in a world of other states and governments who would rejoice in the streets, light bonfires, go arm in arm, drinking, singing, and cheering if they could hear the United States of America is no more. And we don't seem to realize it. We live in a world where, so far as I'm concerned, you could say that is true of the broad majority of most of the nations on the face of this earth who would rejoice in delirious, gigantic orgies reminiscent of the ancient Romish period to hear of the fall of the United States of America. Now here we are, virtually in empire status. I'm not speaking as a colonial power. I'm not speaking of overseas possessions. I'm talking about the fact of our wealth, the fact of our influence, the fact of our nuclear arsenal, our space program, the prestige of the biggest, most vast, unbelievable country the world has ever seen, with 6% of the population of the world spending, wallowing around in, enjoying, living amidst 50% of its wealth. The United States of America is so huge, so big, so incredible that you can take some of the giant corporations and even multinational corporations that are based in the United States, but they all by themselves are bigger than 90% of the countries that are member states in the United Nations. You can take an individual state, such as California, in the United States, and just take a look at the production, at the labor, at the manufactured items, at trade, at money, at population, anything else you want to talk about, and the one state of the United States would be bigger than a vast majority of all the other countries on the face of the earth. It's just a fact. It just happens to be that way. Now, in the meantime, not only do we see this ultimate hypocrisy of wanting to, I guess, appear to be righteous before all the rest of the world, I guess to appear to be so totally righteous that we would never dare engage in any kind of furtive or clandestine activities in another country which might be going communist. We would never be found guilty, never, never, of dumping money to support an anti-communist government or an anti-communist movement, even clandestinely, in some foreign country where if that government went communist, it would be just one more gigantic problem for the United States and the rest of the free world. Oh, no, not us, because that isn't fair. That's not playing according to the rules. Now, while we know, or at least we ought to know, that the Soviet Union doesn't recognize any rules, doesn't know the meaning of the word fair, and they will play the game any way they can, according even to the basic tenets like the Ten Commandments of the Communist Manifesto, which say promises are like pie crusts made to be broken, from Lenin himself. While we know, or we should know, that other states are basically dishonest, they will lie, they will steal, they will cheat, they will murder, they will assassinate, they will rob, they will pilfer, they will expropriate, they will nationalize American industries, they will send their agents into this country, they will engage in every kind of conspiracy to murder and to assassinate people high in our government. But we are righteous, you see. We are holy. We play fair. And we want them to appreciate that. We're sure they will. We're sure that by the time we expose every CIA agent in the entirety of the world and all of these wonderful people who want us dead, who would rejoice in their streets to see us go straight down the drain, will just flood into their public squares, out into their streets, and in their newspapers and their various nationalistic and government-controlled media. They will laud and praise America and say what a marvelous country she is. Look at that. Look at that honesty. Look at that integrity. Look at that quality of government. Isn't it wonderful that America doesn't have such a thing as a spy? America doesn't have such a thing as an undercover agent. Why, we know who they are, where they live, what their address is, what their habits are, and what time to expect them home from dinner so we can machine gun them down on the way from their car to their front door to be greeted by their wife. Because America is honest. America is open-minded. America is righteous. Isn't America wonderful? We got to be kidding. Somebody's got to be crazy. Somebody's got to be so irrational as to look like a hideous laughing baboon disappearing in the slime of a gloomy mist in the rainforest, screaming to himself after he's gotten drunk on about a gallon of pulque. It doesn't make sense. Here we are, pushed not to our own liking into virtually empire status. And there are only two possible ways in which we can depend upon maintaining that status. If you don't wish the term empire, then let's just say we're a great nation. Then we won't have any argument. We also happen to be a democratic nation. We happen to believe in the basic freedoms and the dignity of humankind. We happen to believe precious are those founding concepts and precepts of our forebears and founding fathers in the United States who could envision such an absolutely marvelous biblical-like document as the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, as the Constitution of the United States of America. So instead of arguing for the moment mentally about what we are, if we just want to say we're a great nation and a marvelous nation and a fabulously wealthy nation, let's get on about the business of talking about whether we want to give it up or not. If we don't want to give it up, if we don't want not only to see it drained away and taken from us, but we want even to increase it and to proliferate the blessings and the wealth, not only among our own citizens, but to bequeath more of a share of it to others abroad, then there are only two ways by which we can keep it. And the one way is either by the force of our military, with all that that entails, or by trusting in God. Now, we are not going to trust in God, so let's deal with the practical fact the way things really are. The only way the physical United States of America can depend to survive, can depend upon any survival in this gigantic global conflict, even now beginning to shape up with the 2 billion people on the one side of the world who are lusting after the wealth that we have and want to take away the freedoms that we have. The only possible way then, humanly, for the United States of America to keep it, is to maintain the kind of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, other auxiliary services, which is required to maintain the status of empire, or of number one, or whatever it is we conceive ourselves to be. Now take a look at what has been happening. In the first place, if you want to be an empire, you have to maintain legions. Now legions are professional soldiers. Legionnaires are people who, while they may come from the dregs of society, the jails or what have you, a la the ancient Romish period and some of the other great governments of the past, whether you're talking to the Carthaginians, the Greeks, Spartans, the Romans, and some of the other empires which have toppled and fallen, all the way back to ancient Babylon, Syria, Egypt. Legionnaires, you see, were professional soldiers. They were trained to kill. They were a killing machine. Legionnaires were the stuff and the metal of the kind of a human individual whose very life was professionally dedicated to becoming a killer. That was his entire purpose in life. And he was trained that it was necessary, perhaps, for him to die. He was a professional soldier who knew when he took up the arms and the uniform of his country that his patriotism was not just a nostalgic or a rather dramatic idea of how he would look in the uniform, of the lovely girls he could go out with, of the exciting dates in the service club, of the trip back home on leave to roar around in the convertible with his uniform plainly visible so he would be attractive to all the little cute chicks at home, to maybe put in a couple or 3 years, maybe learn a technique, some special branch of service that could give him some type of vocational interest when he got out, put in his time, have a glorious trip of it, join the Navy to see the world, keep out of trouble, be off the streets, have the choice between the probation officer and the juvenile department of either going into the Marines or going to jail. No, none of these things. The professional legionnaire knew that he would be ordered into battle, and that he would be ordered into battle by a commander who may have decided to sacrifice his life because of the broad view of a battle which must be won, but perhaps certain minor skirmishes which would be lost, and even in the winning of the battle, that there would be casualties. But the United States has no legions, and the United States is determined it will not even maintain a professional army, a professional navy, a professional Marine Corps, Coast Guard, or any other auxiliary service, because basically today, as a result of what we saw first in Korea, and then very obnoxiously into hideous proportions, not only the My Lai massacre, but what was called fragging of officers in Vietnam, boiled over into the public consciousness to prove to us that we have lost the stuff of empire. We have lost the metal of number one. Because, you see, I don't know whether it all began with the mother who wanted to sue the Marine Corps DI at Camp Lejeune, or whether it began with revelations from turned-off boots who would go over the hill to tell people the DI had called him a dirty name, or whether somebody was killed in training, which has happened in the past, or whether someone lost his life because of the rigors of an obstacle course in a Marine Corps boot camp. But somehow, gradually, insistently, and primarily as a result of overexposure and of constant torturous coverage by the press of some of these alleged horrible treatments of young men in the military services, the whole feeling of the military began to change. It was only in Korea, because even though while defections may have occurred, while desertions did occur, while there were actually even cases of people being put to death for desertion under fire in World War II, that was basically not known. Maybe some people could accuse it was more of a controlled press because of the war. Whatever they will accuse, that's history, that's water over the dam. But the fact is that most Americans were basically given the notion of great patriotism, of great courage and bravery under fire on the part of our troops in World War II. And the story of defections or of people collaborating with the enemy or of betraying their own buddies in a prison camp to prolong their own lives or of open defections to live behind enemy lines and cooperate with the enemy, this was virtually unknown in World War II. But it became known in Korea. And for the first time, in the wake of Korea, we had to understand that American military personnel had deserted not only their army, but they deserted their country and gone to live in China. Now, we have long since seen some of them have been repatriated. They have come back to the United States, and we have seen that they learned some rather severe lessons, but it took them 10, 15, or whatever years to learn those lessons. But now comes the agony of this long conflict in Vietnam, and we begin to see young men refusing to go into battle, directly contravening commands of their officers. And, as if that isn't enough, we now see an open warfare behind the lines among our own troops where the enlisted men were actually killing their own officers, and where officers didn't dare get out there in the rice paddies ahead of some of the enlisted men for fear they would be the ones end up with a bullet in their back. I remember so well one motion picture, rather a gripping one, absolutely loaded with psychology, which showed this poor, little, old, scared, misunderstood boot who went into the military service, ended up somewhere in Europe, found himself holding a rifle, dressed in olive garb, didn't know what in the world he was doing there or why, wouldn't want to hurt a fly, wouldn't even step on a crack for fear of breaking his mother's back, and always whispered when walking by graveyards. The kind of a guy that wouldn't pluck the wings off a butterfly. Well, of course, who would? Mostly they just stick a needle in them and press them in a book. But at any rate, here he was, being told to kill somebody. It was a marvelous revelation to him that they actually meant it when he was out on the firing line in boot camp, when they were trying to toughen him up with a lot of harsh language and a lot of long hours and 20-mile hikes with big packs on his back, when they were trying to make him wade shallow lagoons and jump over ditches and climb ropes and obstacles and jump through tires and roll around inside of various obstacle courses, when they were trying to teach him how to stab a dummy with a bayonet, teach him how to handle a mortar or a bazooka or a light machine gun, to strip down and take apart his rifle and clean it and put it back together again blindfolded, and if he made a mistake on the rifle range, to open that thing, and it was kind of difficult, you remember the Garand M1, with his nose, with maybe the DI sitting on his shoulders to get him down in a sitting position to zero in on that dumb target he couldn't seem to hit, when he used to hit all the tin cans and rabbits he wanted to as a boy with a .22, but that thing kicked back, that big old .30-06 there. So this poor kid finds himself in olive drab after all of that training, and marvelously, his sergeant's telling him to go shoot a German over there. Go kill somebody. Who, me? I don't want to kill anybody. I'm just Harmless Harry. Say, fellas, let me out of here. And so Harmless Harry decides he's not about to go to war, even though he'd been recruited by his government, his country, and his army. So events followed an incredible story. It had a lot of flashbacks. Oh, it showed the most marvelous tete-a-tete between himself and his girlfriend at the corner malt shop. It showed all the talks with mother, showed him as a little boy. From then on, it was him waiting his moment of execution because he deserted in the face of enemy fire, and he was going to be put to death. He's going to be hung. I believe they hung him. Maybe I'm mistaken. I think what they did is stand him up in front of a firing squad in some snowbound field in France somewhere. And this was impending. He knew it was going to happen. It was just waiting. It was a matter of hours. And as he's waiting for the firing squad, you just wring every tear out of it in this movie. Oh, no, don't kill that kid, and on and on. And by the time they got to the final scene, which was so, you know, grisly because they're showing all these flashbacks, and then here's this frightened to death young kid looking, oh, no, you know, in these whole line of horrible little O's at the end of these rifles leveled at him, and the whole movie is over when you hear the loud crash. Bang, and just black film, and no the end, you know, no happy sunset, no horse fading away into the distance, just black, theaters dark, empty. That's it, folks. No credits, they were all at the beginning, time to go home. It was very effective. It was absolutely shocking. And you know, it made the millions of Americans who saw it just about hate our own military. It made them just about hate the Army and hate the concept of even the necessity to maintain an army. Now, they want their automobiles. They want their homes. They want their jobs. They want their freedom. They want the Bill of Rights. They want the Constitution. They want all their guarantees. We want our programs. We want HEW. We want housing subsidies and food stamps and welfare programs and help for the poor. We don't want doctor slowdowns. We don't want high taxes. We want automobiles and vacations and campers and all the beautiful wealth of 50% of the wealth of the world shared by 6% of the population of the world. But we are determined we shall not maintain the kind of a military organization that can guarantee we keep our wealth. Now, I already said there's another way, but of course you and I both know we'd be crazier than that mandrill I can talk about if we think this world, let alone the United States of America, is going to depend upon God. Even though God says in Isaiah 40, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sits upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof, the nations, are like grasshoppers, that he stretches out the heavens as a curtain. God, he says, to whom will you liken me, or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold who has created these things, the universe, the heavens, the solar system, the sun, the moon, and the earth." And he says, "Have you not known, have you not heard that the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth, faints not, neither is weary, there is no searching of his understanding. He gives power to the faint. To them that have no might, he increases strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall fall, but they that wait upon the eternal shall renew their strength." Then comes that famous Bible text so many people know. "They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." He says he holds nations in the hollow of his hand. He says all countries are as the small dust of the balance. He sets up and deposes kings, rulers, countries, and governments. But we don't believe that. So we're not going to depend upon God. But what doesn't make sense to me, as a minister, an evangelist, a news commentator, an observer, is knowing we won't trust God, I can't understand why we want to tear down our military. You ought to think about that, and then write to the current number of the Plain Truth. You can have it by return mail free of charge if you will call right now, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. Also request this article or booklet on the Red Horse of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse on war. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. It's free of charge, no price. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.